for the sake of whoever is running the tape room, I'll say let's roll the tape. My name is Peter Lundholm, and I'm chaplain at Memorial Hospital in Cambridge, Minnesota. The subject of my presentation tonight is a recovery of experience toward a renewal of baptismal piety. Now, I realize that this may be a little different tack than some of what I've done in the earlier sessions. And I know, for instance, for the Mannings, this may not exactly apply. I think that there is a problem or an issue that's common for all of us, no matter what particular religious perspective we may have. That I see as integrating our own personal experience with our faith, with our religious tradition, whatever that might be. And I think that's a continuing issue for many of us. And I'm going to approach this from the perspective of looking at rites of initiation, particularly Christian rites of initiation, but I believe that this applies under a number of circumstances. In about the 3rd century, there was a movement towards general acceptability of Christian belief, of Christian practice, Christian faith, in the whole of the Roman Empire. And that really marked a turning point for believers in that particular religious tradition. And it marked a turning point particularly with the rites of initiation. Once people no longer had to make a very serious choice and decision to affiliate with this particular range of religious belief, then it became, it could be something that somebody did for popular reasons or for any number of reasons, affiliating with a particular religious tradition. And that meant that the early Christians needed to rethink their practice of baptism. There is an example from the first part of the 3rd century near Alexandria, a basic outline of the kinds of practices that were held, that were part of Christianity in that area, as far as their rites of initiation. And this is a basic outline of that experience. Those who were to be baptized were daily instructed and purified for a period of time that roughly coincided with our Lenten season. So that for a period of 40 days or so, they went through a period of instruction and supervision. And for that matter, they may have undergone a period of supervision of up to several years prior to that time. But this beginning, at the beginning of Lent, they were enrolled as candidates for baptism. And so they were instructed then daily and went through purification rites for that period of time. They were examined by the bishop, and if they were found worthy, they were directed to bathe, to be exercised on Thursday of Holy Week, and also to repeat the text of the Creed, which was given them the previous Sunday. They fasted on Good Friday. And Saturday of Holy Week, the bishop exercised them again and read to them many inspirational works. Following that, the Easter Vigil began at cockcrow on Easter Eve, when the water was blessed. 2 vials of oil were also blessed by the bishop. The candidates for baptism then undressed, formally renounced Satan, and were anointed with the oil of exorcism. A deacon led each person in turn down into the baptismal water. There a presbyter immersed him or her after he or she answered affirmatively to each of the three sections of the creed. Then the baptized was anointed by the presbyter with the oil of blessing. They were dried and instructed to put on white robes. The bishop anointed them again with the oil of blessing, made the sign of the cross on the forehead of each person, and gave each person the kiss of peace. And then the rite of initiation concluded with the admission of the newly baptized to the Lord's Supper. And so that then was a whole complex of ritual that they went through as a part of their becoming Christian, being formally admitted to the Christian group. And you notice that it includes not only the baptism itself, but it also includes what we know as confirmation. The bishop, when he uses the oil of blessing, is really doing what we now know today as confirmation. And they will follow that by their participation in the Lord's Supper. So that Lord's Supper was also a part of that first experience of entering into the Christian church. Now, you notice some things in that. They're already showing some signs of change with the kinds of instruction that they're getting, that very formal period of instruction. And prior to that, that probably was not necessary, prior to the general acceptance of Christianity by the Roman establishment. I draw your attention then to the fact that there is also confirmation and communion as a part of that rite. There were three major developments then took place following the 3rd century. Following the 3rd century up to the time of the Reformation. Those changes, those developments, happened primarily in the Church of the West. Eastern Orthodoxy really took a different kind of an attitude and kept that rite of initiation together as one unitary kind of an experience, and they still do today. In the Eastern Orthodox tradition, it's still common practice to commune infants when they are baptized. There's in fact a special kind of utensil that's used to dip the wafer or the bread into the wine and then give that to the infant following the infant's baptism. So there is a unity of that particular liturgical rite that is true still today in the Eastern Orthodox Church that didn't happen in the Western churches. There were several things that did happen. First of all, confirmation was restricted to the bishop, or rather it was the bishop had to be present and involved in the rite of confirmation. That's still true in Roman Catholic churches, of course. Not true in Lutheran churches. But up until the time of the Reformation, that was true. And so there were many congregations where baptism was done then by the local priest, and it was not until sometime later that confirmation was done. Particularly, a second factor in that, particularly in mission areas where parishes were widely scattered over a large distance, and where there was a shortage of clergy, where the bishop may have been hundreds of miles off, and it was way on the frontiers of the empire, so transportation was not an easy thing. Baptism would then have to be waited for a long period of time, even some years. The confirmation would have to be waited for. The baptism itself could be performed. So you gradually see how that rite of confirmation was separated from the experience of baptism, became fragmented. As the rites fragmented, baptism was less and less seen as an entry into communion, and communion became more and more focused upon the the elements of communion themselves, rather than as a meal of the community where Christ was present. The presence of God became more and more focused and situated in the elements themselves. And the result was an increasing kind of sacramental realism and clericalism. Two other responses to this kind of fragmentation that happened, or this dilution of the rites of initiation, were the rise of monasticism. The monastic orders really developed in response to this beginning rise in popularity and kind of a dilution of the importance of the rites of initiation. And it was an attempt to incorporate experience, felt faith and experienced faith, rather than just kind of going through the formal rites of the liturgy. Another response to that dissolution of the rites was the development of a process which was parallel in many ways to that of baptism. And these were the rites of confession. Also, beginning in about the 3rd century, we begin to find rites of confession that were really paralleled, the rites of initiation. Once again, though, in the Western churches, the rites of confession became a kind of clerical specialty. For instance, that parallel development, there developed an order of penitents who were enrolled at the beginning of Lent, and then went through a whole process that paralleled the kind of instruction that happened with baptismal candidates. And then they made a confession prior to Easter, and then returned again to their participation in communion. The reformers looked at all those moves, and I think in many ways some of the Protestant Reformation was really an attempt to reform that area of Christian life and to revitalize a whole understanding of baptism, to really recover a kind of baptismal piety. We have some pretty good examples of that. Luther certainly talked about the use of confession as a regular practice of Christian faith. But one of the things that happened was that in the 18th century, with the Enlightenment, a lot of those efforts to reincorporate that practice of confession and revitalize the baptismal spirituality, piety, were really kind of subverted by the Enlightenment. They took a very dim view of all kinds of sacramental practices and really attempted to rationalize those processes as much as they could. There's a quote from Martin Marty that I wanted to share with you at this point. With surprising suddenness, we have discovered almost too late that the neglect of confession has meant a relapse in the modern world of Christians into two false ways, legalism and relaxation. Under the quiet roofs, along the broad tree-lined avenues of our villages, in the glass and steel of our apartments, on our farms, live people who use gentility to cover up terror. They use politeness to cover up loneliness, apathy to cover up despair, escape to cover up the vacuum that will not let us be alone with ourselves. In the face of this condition, people of other professions who deal with persons ask the churches why they have given up their greatest disciplinary and therapeutic treasure, confession of sins and absolution. My sense is that this process of of enlightenment and demythologizing of our experience has occurred to the point where few of us, if any, would have any kind of experiential comment or content when we talk about our baptismal faith. We really don't do a good job of integrating our faith with our experience. To the point that when we quote Romans, talking about a life wherein we daily die to sin and rise to newness of life, that really isn't an integrated kind of an experience. And I think we struggle with that. And we can talk in abstractions about that. We can cite that kind of scriptural passage. But we really have very little experiential content to that kind of statement. And what I would argue is that the 12-step processes, and here I'm going to bring in the addiction part of it, is that the 12-step processes offer us one possibility, one opportunity to a renewed experience and a recovery of the experience of daily death and resurrection, a daily living out of our baptismal life. I think of for example, of some of the sayings of the 12-step groups, and I think of their parallels in terms of our Christian experience, in terms of our own particular religious experience. One of the sayings of AA or 12-step movements is one day at a time. I think that very easily translates into an experience of a daily confrontation with our own limitations as a human being, as human beings, and coming to grips with that, a facing of that, a daily death and resurrection, if you will. People in AA and other 12-step movements will talk about being recovering, talk about themselves as recovering, but not cured. Well, I mean, if I were to say to ask Bill here if he was cured, no way.
Daily reprieve.
It's a daily reprieve. It's a daily process. And I think in that connection of a parallel from our, what is some for a religious Christian tradition for some of us, of the idea that we are at one and the same time sinful and saints, sinful and justified. We're not recovered, we're not cured. But this is a daily kind of a process. I also think of the 12-step groups as being a kind of a possible community for many people where they can work at integrating their particular spirituality, their particular religious affiliation with their daily life. I think of the kinds of experiences that are had in 12-step groups of a very open and honest kind of an experience, but also of sometimes some confrontation that happens in there. In a 12-step group, we don't allow things just to kind of be rationalized, denied. There is a responsibility of the members of the group to confront each other. I can remember instances hearing somebody ask somebody else, well, maybe you're missing your chemicals right now. You sound like you're irritated about something. You sound like you haven't let go of a particular issue. You haven't dealt with that particular thing. And so there is the possibility of supporting each other in a very direct and honest way. And people in that group really depend upon each other to keep each other sober, to keep each other healthy, to keep each other straight. There is a tradition in Christian circles as well, where the community of faith becomes a community wherein mutual consolation, conversation, and correction are possible. And that is primarily in a community where confession is practiced. Not so much between parishioners and a priest, but where there is ongoing, honest conversation about each other's practice of the faith. And there is a real attempt to integrate one's faith and one's experience. And again, I would suggest that 12-step groups offer us an opportunity. One possibility, there may be others, for that kind of integration of our experience and our faith. I want to quote again from one of the books that I have quoted several times in my sessions. Excuse me. This is John Keller in his book, Let Go, Let God. I learned something of God's grace from the non-religious fellowship of AA. First of all, it became clear that God's gracious presence, help, and involvement with his people is not limited only to those who come to confess Christ as Lord, as is too often or too frequently implied in some preaching and teaching. Whenever and wherever and in whatever manner a person experiences the personal reality and acceptance of human pain, brokenness, and limitation, God is present with grace and strength. Whether or not the person is aware of it, and whether or not a person believes in God in a particular way, moralistic attitudes and doctrines within the church have provided considerable contamination and distortion of this truth. I want to suggest again that I think that the 12-step groups offer us an opportunity to really put this into practice and to integrate our faith and our life, our faith and our experience. I want to then begin opening this up to the rest of you. That's kind of that's really been a theme for me in my own ministry. And in my developing appreciation for AA and for other 12-step groups, that they really do offer us this opportunity. And I would invite your response to that.
I'm not sure that if you're suggesting this or not, but I'm wondering if you're saying anything at all about the process of bringing people to baptism now, and is it too easy? Is the process short-circuited? Are we baptizing people into the church with little or no preparation, comparatively speaking, and are we reaping the fallout of that?
Yeah, I think that's a big part of it. You know, that's kind of the initial setup for us in that experience. But given that setup, then what do we do with that? You know? And I think that the 12-step groups would offer us a way to integrate that in a better way. What would other responses be to that? I think we can all take a look at and see, looking at our history, kind of how some of this has been separated and fragmented for us.
In the early centuries, the baptism didn't take place at birth, at infancy, did it?
Some instances there seem to be.
Was it more than adulthood?
Yeah, in some instances it seems to be that that whole families were baptized, infants included. But in the very early centuries, I don't know that that was an issue. Where it becomes an issue is after the 3rd century, really, when commitment to a particular faith is no longer a matter of some serious thought and some serious choices.
My infant baptism always bothered me terribly because I didn't make the choice. So in 1978, when I was in Israel, I chose to be baptized.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt better about that because now I made the choice.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What would some of your responses be to that?
I agree with my, I believe in the second baptism of the Holy Spirit because I was baptized too and I strayed away and then later on the Holy Spirit spoke in a way to me, taking a Bible out, and I, ever since, I call that my second baptism.
Mm-hmm. So would that have been an effort on your part to really integrate your own experience with your faith? Could you? I can imagine some pastors squirming with that.
They squirm with a lot of things.
Yeah.
A lot of things happen between the time you're an infant and you become an adult. Think of what happened in Europe during the terrible wars there, and the last one in particular. If you were baptized as an infant, entirely in cultural and economic and other conditions, they're going to change your lifestyle, and maybe you'll have to have a new commitment somewhere in there.
Mm-hmm.
But can you be baptized 3 times, 4 times, 5 times? That's what Martin Luther played, the daily aspect, the daily remembrance of your baptism. And the problem with adult baptism, as far as I can understand it, is that it puts too much emphasis on the individual's action. That's why we continue with infant baptism, because it's the Spirit that baptizes. It doesn't matter that the infant understands what's going on. We do have a need for rituals, and when someone, I mean, I experienced a conversion, and I wish I would have had something to sort of ritualize it.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't, and I don't need it.
Mm-hmm.
I know what happened, and I still consider that the conversion is ongoing.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was sort of a intensification. And I can slack, and I can, but something will come along, Spirit invokes a response, and it's intensified to the point of where it reminds me of the time that I went through my conversion.
Mm-hmm.
Peter, wouldn't it help if, I've been in on some of these where you have services of renewal of your baptism.
Mm-hmm.
I think lots of us, you know, we certainly didn't know what was going on as an infant, but an occasional participation in services like that, where they go through it again about what happened with your baptism, what does it mean, and I think of Campus Church particularly, you know, there where they go through that at Lent, And if you participate in that, I mean, with the ashes on you, you know, what is all this about and what does it mean? And I think being reminded of that makes us aware of what that baptism really is and how great it is. And I remember being in the Catholic Church when I've been up with you, we go over to St. John's and that Lenten service is after midnight on Easter.
The Easter vigil.
That's a baptism all over again, and they come and sprinkle you, the whole congregation with it. You know, it is so significant to know what this was and why it should be such a big part of our life. But I think it has to be reinforced with that kind of services, which we usually drop and should be reinstituted in our own church service. And I remember reading the novel, was it Pasternak? He was a Russian writer.
Or Tolstoy?
No.
Pasternak,
isn't that what it's named?
Yeah.
Yeah, he talks about it too. You know, he was deprived of all this, as the Russians didn't believe in it and so on. He was so glad that in his mind, his nanny had taken him to be baptized. And he knew that as a promise. And when he was awarded the Nobel Prize, Russia wouldn't let him go. So it didn't make any difference to him. He was a free person. He knew it because he was a child of God. And it was all because this nanny that he'd had had secretly taken him and been baptized. And I thought that was a tremendous confession for me, that he knew what this person had done, even though the rest of the people, his parents, didn't even know. He felt a free spirit that was given to him in the baptism.
I'm convinced that the kinds of rituals you're talking about are really important. But what I'm also coming to believe is that some kind of daily or weekly discipline in a community can also be an important part of that, and that 12 steps might offer us a way to do some of that. If we look at the 12 steps, that is really a process of reconciliation, of coming to terms with oneself, and coming to terms with one's relationship to other people. And there is that for confession. I saw a hand back in the back row here.
Well, I guess I was getting confused. People were talking about the adult versus, you know, the baptism thing, and you had been talking about the 12 steps, and I was trying for the life of me, trying to put them together. I think what you have to say is quite correct, but and I think a lot of people would agree, but how would you implement this?
I think we can offer this, you know. I think we can have a very hospitable attitude towards 12-step groups within our religious communities, for one thing. Plus, I think we can take some of this kind of, I think in some sense, the principles of the 12 steps, or if we would want to call it a kind of a discipline, really offers us some direction. And I don't see anything that would prevent us from incorporating some of this in the life of our particular religious congregation. Small groups where this confidentiality is practiced, where, you know, the anonymity that is a part of AA or GA or OA or NA is a very much a part of it. But then there is the very honest conversation and support that is a part of that experience. I don't think there's anything that would keep us from doing that. You know, just, I think, simply the desire of people in our congregations would be what's necessary.
And then, like, do you foresee, Peter, like, you know, if it wasn't a specific single addiction, but everybody kind of had their own things, I mean, wouldn't that get kind of confusing, or would you just use the 12 steps as a framework? And
I think we could use 12 steps as a framework for that. And in fact, I'm aware of some situations where that is exactly what's done.
It's kind of personal and community growth.
Right. Where instead of a specific addiction, what people are identifying with is their own human limitations. And I think there's some advantage to the kinds of specific groups. And Bill, you talked about some of that last night, how you felt more at home with an NA group than an AA group.
I did. And it's okay now. You know, I've got the connection, so I can, the recovery's the same all over, to get the connection.
So there may be occasion where specific issues, where some people within a congregation have specific questions or concerns in common that they're facing, that they're dealing with. And so a group may be develop around that, or a subgroup may develop around that, where they could feel particularly supported and know that they're understood by the people in that group. Yeah, Bill.
In Narcotics Anonymous, they use the word addiction in the first step, you know, instead of drugs or alcohol, you know, it's just addictions. So that's, you know, if I start reading too much because I don't want to deal with something, you know, I'm shutting my life off. I'm addicted, you know. But in my home group in Bellingham, it's kind of, they use that, that's pretty lived by it. You know, I quit smoking cigarettes by talking about it in meetings, you know. And, you know, you talk about relationships, you know, it's a pretty open, it's not a hard line where it's only, you know, you can only talk about drugs in here, you know. It's kind of, if it's causing your life some trouble, work on it. But what I was thinking when you were talking about rituals of renewal and stuff, I just came to mind at the first step meeting.
Okay.
You know, like when a newcomer comes in, we have what's called a first step meeting, and people talk, and it's great to remember, because sometimes, you know, after you've been around for quite a few years, you kind of tend to forget how ugly it was. So you just tell a little bit of your story, and then they get to find out that it's okay to talk about what's really going on. They tell some of their story, and that's living proof that it's not, didn't get you better out there. You know, you still can get really screwed up on dry beer, and they haven't come up with heroin free yet. So, that's pretty rejuvenating, you know, to get to see some guy coming up the street all beat up and get to remember when you were there and realize you're not there now, and you go, yeah, I'm gonna keep doing this.
And an opportunity to tell a story.
Something, I don't know, some people say that's doing drug logs and stuff, and it can be, but sometimes, you know, to go back and remember how it was makes you real damn glad it's not that way no more.
Okay, yeah.
Walter Wangren, you know, who writes that
sure.
Page in the Lutheran, spoke at the seminary and this weekend-long thing, and he was talking about that he thought one of the real gifts of AA was just that people told the story, that so many people in the church don't really have or feel like they have the place to tell their story. It's never appropriate. We work at hiding our feelings, not letting them out. And so that is one of the most powerful things. Someone goes to an AA meeting is they have a chance, they have a venue to tell the story. And that there's something, I mean, it's for centuries and centuries and centuries back, we had a tradition where there was oral stories told. And I mean, that's the way the scriptures came to us. You know, they were, the stories were told for a generation before they were ever written down. And in the Old Testament, you know, it's clear the way they were written was a lot of the stories you could tell that they're written so they could be memorized.
Right.
There's all kinds of mnemonic devices to tell the story. But just that's something that the church could definitely take from 12 steps is some way for people to put their stories into words and have people there to listen to it. Well, I think one of the most powerful things also about AA, why it works, is when you hear someone tell their story and you go, well, that's just what I did. That's just the way I feel. And you always thought that you were the only one like that.
How about talking about your struggles? Is that a part of it? See, and I think there is real value in being able to do that.
It, it does happen sometimes. You'll be in adult forums, you know, where people are really talking about their life and their experience and their struggles. Because a lot of times when you hear people talk about the struggle between their Mondays and their Sundays, about, you know, how hard it is for them to be a Christian at work, or just to talk about being a Christian at work. And you can see it when you see people's eyes and they're connecting with, you know, the same thing. So that it does go on in the church, but there's not a regular place for it.
And we could do more of that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In our church, we live in a little town, only about 8,000. But for about 5 years now, a group has met every Tuesday morning at 7 o'clock. And the pastor started out calling it Source. I'm not sure why. I believe that the maximum number has been 9 people. And my husband and I always go because it fits into our schedule just fine. And the pastor usually starts the coffee, or if he's late, one of us does. And now we've gotten to the point where we just have bread in the fridge and have an old toaster there, so we have toast and coffee. And what we do, we read the scriptures for the following Sunday. And we really tear into them with our Bibles and our commentaries and so forth. And it gets extremely interesting. But we have become we know each other so well, and there's been so much sharing. I recall one Tuesday morning where one of the girls mentioned something about a burden that Betty had been carrying in her mind for several months. I didn't know anything about this at all. And Betty begins to cry. Well, it turns out that there was a serious family problem that she had just held within herself. So she began to talk about it, and it seemed like it was such a relief to her to share it with the rest of us. It was just wonderful for her. And the fellowship that we've experienced in that little group has been just tremendous.
Mm-hmm.
And my husband and I just wouldn't whip. We wouldn't miss it. It's the high point of the week.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's become a very central part of your faith, mm-hmm. and of your experience of that. I know from just what reading I've done that integrating one's faith, one's religious belief, and one's lifestyle is also part of the Jewish tradition. And I'm wondering if any of the Mannings would care to comment about struggles with that, or what you do with that.
Well, it seems to me it's gotten watered down very much. That I remember my parents and my in-laws, that faith and religion meant a lot more to them, and they really lived it, observing the Sabbath and saying prayers. And as the generations come and go, it's they don't think it's that important anymore.
Uh-huh.
And in my experience anyway, Jews don't so much get together and discuss personal issues or emotions. They sort of don't exist,
mm-hmm.
in my experience.
Uh-huh.
May I point up an interesting observation? I have a friend who I'm working with who is Jewish, and I have really appreciated how she has shared with me her beliefs and agrees that but Christians have lost a lot of, it's too easy now. Everything is too easy, and you know, we're copping out on the convictions we all need to apply. And I appreciate the input from your beliefs as well as ours. I think they're very important. I think they keep us molded together. We still are all one regardless of where we're coming from.
Well, that's just it.
We have a lot to learn from that.
Mm-hmm. Would that be a felt need for people in your tradition to have some more cohesive or a place where you can talk about the issues you're wrestling with, or find support for yourselves.
I think it'd be very important, but as far as I know, it does not exist.
Hmm. Okay.
One of the things about 12-step, they tell you to go when you don't want to go. That's the time you go. So if you go all the time, and people get to know you, when you come in acting weird, a friend, you know, somebody that loves you is going to come up and say, you know, what's bothering you? How you doing? And you might just sit there and hold it, but when somebody asks, then all right, you know, I can finally spill it. I don't got to carry this around anymore.
Mm-hmm. Somebody notices and they say something about it. Yeah. Okay. And I see that as a real valuable thing.
I just wanted to say that my experience has been that I've gone to, let's say, Bible studies to get support.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I've found about that is that people tend to spiritualize, you know, their comments. You know, let's say something along the lines of, you know, relating a story out of scripture to your experience that you're sharing or something like that. Or they'll say something in spiritual terms that will have kind of an overlay of, this is what you should be doing to it.
Okay.
And then if you go to a 12-step group, like I've just started to go to up here, it's a different, totally different thing. One thing is not crosstalk.
Right.
You're just sharing.
Yeah.
And then you can really speak as you would speak naturally without spiritual language.
Uh-huh. And there isn't advice giving.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cloaked in spiritual language or otherwise.
There isn't.
Right.
Suggestions. If you want, I'll tell you what I did. If you like it, you know, go for it. If you don't, ask somebody else. But not, you need to do this. I don't know, you know, what somebody mm-hmm. else needs to do. I hardly ever know what I need to do, really. Just get lucky sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a lot of advice giving, but it's with the spirit behind it's differently. What you talk about, let go, let God. One of the great things in that book for me was where he draws the distinction between moralism and morality.
Mm-hmm.
So much Christian speech and behavior is ill-defined, ill-disguised moralism.
Right.
You know, where we're going around telling people what we want them to do.
Or what we think they should do.
What we want them to do.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But the spirit, usually in 12-step, it really is, well, this is what I did, this is what works for me. Because the emphasis is, because they can turn around and tell you, if you're not working your own program, I mean, you know, you can't work someone else's program. Someone else can't work your program for you.
Mm-hmm.
So you cannot tell someone else what to do.
And I've given some people the right to take my inventory. You know, I trust them, I like their intuition, their judgment, and I've given them the right to take my inventory when they feel that something's wrong, and
mm-hmm.
and that's saved my ass a few times, you know, that have people that will do that.
Right.
And they're getting pretty vulnerable too, because...
Sure. Because they've got to lay out their own, right? Mm-hmm. Any further comments? See, I think one of the things that then we talk about is that we are responsible for our own faith, or the exercise for our faith. I remember Jim Burtness talking one time, and he said one of the things that we do is we teach very well people not to take credit for their faith. But we don't teach people enough about how to take responsibility for their faith. And I think that's right on. I think that's right on target with this. And when we're not giving advice, we're taking responsibility for our own faith. And we're allowing each other to take responsibility for their faith. So again, I think this can be kind of a helpful discipline for us, or potentially that way. Any further thoughts or questions from the group?
How early would you start this? What ages?
I think kids who are for instance, I'm aware of a program for kids ages, I believe it's 8 to 12. Where they're learning about expressing their feelings, they're learning about honesty, they're learning about responsibility for their own behavior. And I think it could be started as early as age 8. Not that it's going to be, there are levels of maturity as to what they can do. I think my experience in listening to fifth steps, for instance, says that a fifth step for somebody younger than about age 14 is a waste of time. People just younger than age 14 don't have the kind of insight necessary to do a fifth step. But again, I'm aware that, for instance, in Catholic circles, they're really talking in some instances about raising the age of first confession to an older age, because kids simply aren't capable of making moral choices or moral distinctions at an age at which they traditionally have done that. So I think there is some, would be some age-specific kinds of things that could be done.
Apart from 12-step programs, I'm wondering now, in the Lutheran Church, since we've gotten our new Lutheran Book of Worship, which is no longer new, but 12 years old, we have the order for individual confession and forgiveness, which Luther never threw out, but a lot of people think he did, and now we're starting to recognize it as there. And the only people I've ever used that with are former Catholics who are now Lutheran, and they say, I really missed that. I really missed going and talking with a priest or another person and confessing and hearing that word. Sunday morning, the corporate confession and forgiveness doesn't quite do it for me. And the people who I've done that with, not all that many times, have felt absolved and perhaps a different way. I think it becomes a matter of feeling, not that they are more forgiven, but they feel more cleansed or whatever. I'm wondering if we need to be looking at a way to encourage more people to do that, and yet in a way that's not heavy-handed or legalistic, but letting people know about the possibility of it in a way larger than what we've been doing.
I think that's very true. I believe that. Yeah.
Speaking as a Catholic that has gone to confession a lot, I think just being involved in, say, a support group like a 12-step program would give, I mean, just personally speaking, give as much satisfaction as the one-to-one contact with pastor or priest or whatever. Mm-hmm. I think it's just getting out some of the things that you're not feeling so good about. Mm-hmm. But that might do it, too.
Yeah.
It seems like, too, if you don't have the absolution, we were talking about that last night in 12-step, you don't have an absolution, and that seems like would be needed. Even though you don't have an absolution, just the act of confessing and speaking to another human being or a group or something is in itself like confessing to God, because you're coming out of yourself, out into the open. Mm-hmm. You're, if you're ashamed, you're open with your shame, you know, you're doing it publicly so that just that public witness is as if God were listening to, or as if someone could give you an absolution.
Mm-hmm. My sense is that the experience of that, being able to do that with somebody and have and be listened to, non-judgmentally, is in a sense an experience of absolution, of acceptance.
For me, it's the direct demands. You know, like going and having a priest say you're okay is one thing, but going right to the person and saying, man, this is what I did. You know, mm-hmm. I did this to you. I don't like my actions no more, and I'm going to try to change, you know.
And I apologize.
Yeah, and it's, you know, mm-hmm. it's... Mm-hmm. And as far as being absolved, this is what I was talking about last night after the thing, was I don't really believe that I need to have a ritual to have my higher power forgive me. It's my stuff that's in the way of the forgiveness is there.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So that's, you know, it's inside word.
Right. Okay. You were going to say something.
I was just going to say what you said. I felt that the group's acceptance of you in spite of your confession of whatever's bothering is a form of absolution.
Right. On one of my relapses, I was the treasurer of a group, and I took their money and went to Yakima. And see, like, that was just exactly what I needed. I needed some humility, you know. I was a 30-day wonder, and here I was, and, you know, I was running a group and all this stuff. So I get to come back and say, your money's in my arm, and I'll pay you back as soon as I can. And I felt really bad. I felt really low. And it was really good, because I did get some humility that I needed out of that. So I got just what I needed. I didn't like the feeling at the time, but it was exactly what I needed.
And you had to take responsibility for that. Yeah. And I think I think it's great.
That was one of those magic moments.
It was real important
yeah,
for you.
It was, yeah.
Yeah. And they accepted that and...
Yeah, but all I got was hugs and loves, and I'm sure I'm glad you're back, I'm glad you didn't die, and you sure don't look very good, but I'm glad you're back.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Okay.
And my sponsor, I always pick the perfect sponsor. He says, I'm not saying it's okay, but when they went to publish the first basic text, they gave a guy $10,000 and he put that in his arm. So you're not doing that bad. So I says that made me feel better too. Uh-huh. I always get that guy that's going to say, you know, you're all right, you'll make it, rather than, you know, I go with my dad if I wanted that.
Okay, yeah. And that kind of brings up another thing. I think one of the ways that the moralism has crept in is through our families. The moralism creeps in through our families. And it's real hard to shake that. And it's real hard to separate that from our religious outlook. And that's a real important task. And knowing that if you want that, you go to your dad. You know? Mm-hmm. But that you don't expect that from your group.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a resource that you can cite as far as looking at that issue or separating families and faith?
Oh, gosh.
I have not. I mean, I can...
Just off the top of my head, no, I don't. Know, but I'm real aware that that's there, and I would gather that probably most of us are. That we have some sense of that we got that from our family.
Like John Bradshaw tapes I've listened to have been really good in saying that one of our problems with ongoing relationships is we're still trying to please our mom, you know, and that's until we do that base divorce, you know, that original divorce. You just kind of spin in your wheels, and I feel that sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Or our dad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Peter, do you have copies of this 12 steps, or where do you get it? I've been on a couple of your sessions, and I know a little bit about it. It's kind of fragmented. If it's all that good, I'd like to know more about it.
Okay.
Jackie had some
copies, and maybe we need to do that. Just get some copies of that.
I just have never...
And make that...
I know it helps people, but I don't know how or what it could do if it was more widely known among people that don't know it.
Mm-hmm.
usually in the service areas in the area of your local newspaper, there'll be a directory of the meetings, and quite a few of them are open.
Mm-hmm. There's also, let me see your questions. One back.
I was copying the 12 steps in the other room yesterday morning. And, some young lad came in and said, what are you doing? And I told him. And he said, well, that's fine, but if you go to any AA office or outlet, they will give you as many copies as you want.
Okay. Yeah. And in most of your phone books,
it's in all the phone books.
The first one of the first listings in the book, the AA, is there, and there's a number to call.
So it's very easy to get it, apparently.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I thank you for your attention again tonight.
Thank you.